Welcome to Your Permission to Pause, a podcast with uplifting and inspiring content to help driven female leaders who want to work smarter, not harder. Concepts of the helper's high arose in the 1980s and has been confirmed in various studies since, and it consists of positive emotions following selfless service to others. And it suggests that there are greater health benefits and increased longevity that are associated with this psychological state. Sounds great, doesn't it? Most research on the science behind why this makes us feel better is centered around a love hormone called oxytocin. And oxytocin plays a role in forming social bonds and how we build trust with others. And it's also the hormone that mothers produce when they breastfeed, which is said to cement their bond with their babies. And when we perform acts of kindness and those selfless acts, it can give our little love hormone a boost. When we participate in these acts of kindness and selfless gestures to other people, we also release dopamine, which is one of the chemical messengers in the brain. And that can give us a euphoric feeling. It's the feel-good brain chemical. And that's what's credited to what has become known as the helper's high. In addition to this, you know, just to add a few more little hormones and neurotransmitters into the cocktail, it's also said to increase serotonin. So that's a neurotransmitter that helps regulate our mood. However, all sounds too good to be true, but what if we have got into a habitual pattern of helping, in inverted commas, that is not serving us or the people that we lead? So what if the messaging about kindness and teamwork and rolling your sleeves up has become so distorted that the only chemical release that you're getting is a heavy dose of cortisol with a dash of adrenaline? Because every time you help, you come away with another four things on your to-do list. So as a recovering, rescuing helper, white knight myself, very common in people that become coaches and also therapy type roles, I totally understand the confusion that arises when you think that you're doing something really positive and helpful and kind, but over time, secretly become resentful because you're depleted and oversubscribed and appear to be doing a lot of what feels like the heavy lifting and that everyone wants a piece of you. So that classic, you know, if you want something done, ask a busy person, that kind of characteristic trait can set us up down a path to burnout if we're not careful. So falling into rescuing type dynamics is a dangerous place to be as a leader. And it's one that is all too common. So on the surface, it can seem altruistic, but can create a dependency that feeds the ego whilst keeping those around us disempowered. A well-meaning helper can prevent the change that they're convinced they are trying to facilitate, and we just stay stuck in this dynamic that is really not helpful for them, for us, and it's certainly not helpful for our organisational needs. Many leaders, especially females, that are very naturally drawn to those nurturing qualities can end up burnt out, stressed out, or at best just exhausted because they're so depleted from this compulsion to save the world or, in the first instance, save their teams. And with mental health issues on the rise and the responsibility of protecting the well-being of our employees is high on so many organizational agendas, the leaders of today are torn between driving for results and supporting those who can get the results. And I noticed this took a particular upturn during the pandemic when suddenly leaders felt the pressure and the conflict that can present itself when you are striving for those numbers and those targets, and at the same time, you're the person that your team turns to in their hour of need. But why do we get ourselves into this pattern? I think there are a couple of reasons. Despite feeling the pressure themselves, I think many female leaders default to the protector. And once that dynamic has settled in, it can be really difficult to break out of. So once again, the conditioning can catch us out. So, you know, we're in a society where it's normal for women to give up their own needs and devote themselves to the needs of others, always putting other people first, and their own needs slip down that priority list. Many women have also got very individual and personal expectations of themselves that they have created through experiences or that they've taken on through family conditioning, messages that they receive throughout their upbringing, that now they can see where perhaps throwaway comments that were planted and reinforced ideas that we do have to put other people before ourselves. And the irony is that most of these comments tend to come from other women. So often women are not helping other women break free from this thinking and this conditioning that we need to put others before ourselves. So given that we are clearly part of the problem, I think it's time that we start to take a bit more seriously that we are also part of that solution. And then we throw in some people-pleasing patterns or some self-worth issues into the mix, and that just adds fuel to the fire. And before we know it, we're practically leading from a place of martyrdom or self-sacrifice. And just like the busy badge, there are strokes of praise for being so selfless and dedicated and caring, but at what cost? For me personally, at the time of recording this, I feel like I've been tested on my own martyrdom tendencies, for full transparency. Recovering from a pretty nasty gastric bug, picture scenes from The Exorcist, yep, spinning head, projectile vomit, further enhanced by a gymnastic-type move from the bed to the ensuite toilet on a possibly hourly basis for the other end. Oh yes, it was the full-on deluxe version. Too much information possibly for this podcast, but horrific experience I wouldn't wish on anybody else. But back to my martyrdom tendencies, there would have been a time where I would have pushed through that to make everything easier and better and more pleasant for everyone else, despite how terrible I was feeling. But instead, on this occasion, I did allow myself to fully attend to my own needs in order to get better. Initially, that wasn't too bad as I was physically stopped in my tracks. But actually, what I noticed was when it comes to the crunch, they, in this case, my family, so three teenagers and a husband, the dog sorted himself out, really, they can cope and they can work it out for themselves. Now, my kids are older, they are teenagers, so they are able to cook and do most things themselves. Was the washing done to my standard and did it follow my process? No, but they did have clean clothes and clean bedding. Did they eat nutritious home-cooked food each night? Possibly, possibly not. I was feeling far too green to inquire about their menu plan, but they're still alive and they've probably gained a few additional culinary skills, or at least an appreciation of maybe what I do in the process. And so my point is that when we're forced to let go and step out of that hero role, the world doesn't actually fall apart, contrary to rumour. Whether it's your home team, i.e. your family, or your literal team at work, I really think that we need to examine how we're showing up for ourselves as well as how we're showing up for them. So if any of this resonates, the white knight syndrome, martyrdom, self-sacrifice, or rescuing behaviours, not the gastric bug, then here are some things that you can start to pay attention to so that you can gradually withdraw from any slightly dysfunctional dynamics that could be depleting you and holding your team back in the process. So let's start with the compulsion to fix them and take responsibility for them. It's really easy when you have a team that are up against it in terms of targets or KPIs or workload, and when you can clearly see that they may be struggling with how they're coping with that, it's really easy to unconsciously take on that responsibility. In terms of fixing them, for a start, it's highly unlikely that they're actually broken. And yes, I know that you just want what's best for them. And in lots of instances, particularly if we've come through the ranks or we've done their job or we've got lots of experience, it's very easy to step in and do it for them or show them a quicker way or something more efficient or make suggestions. And what we've got to do is recognize that compulsion to fix and take responsibility and just stop and start to listen better. Because in the race to get through your to-do list and possibly feeling the pressure of them trying to get through theirs, which probably contributes to you getting through yours, you're probably in autopilot. Most of us are most of the time anyway. And so as soon as you hear a potential problem or a challenge, it's really easy to dive in there with a bit of solutioneering. So stop and listen, really listen to what's being said, as well as to what isn't being said. Because sometimes we can rush in to fix and we fix the wrong problem. So first thing is make it your job to understand versus solve. And you'll probably be pleasantly surprised at how much people can solve for themselves. And reflective listening can be a really powerful tool. It can be a powerful tool for you as the listener, because it helps you to slow down and withdraw from that autopilot. Because if you are taking time and pauses to summarize and reflect back what you're hearing, what you're sensing, what you're feeling from what they are saying or not saying, it can really slow down both of your thinking. And if you have someone that's coming to you that perhaps is on overdrive, by you slowing yourself down with some reflective listening can actually help regulate their pace to something that is much more meaningful. So when we slow down the whole process by reflective listening, it gets you out of, I need to solve the problem now. And it really helps the person that's come to you, because when somebody reflects back to us and holds the mirror, we can often see things from a very different perspective than we perhaps could on our own. And then there's the listening to ourselves bit. So managing our own internal dialogue. So not only do we need to listen to the person in front of us, but we need to listen to what our unconscious is saying to us. So many leaders talk about the pressure they feel to have all the answers just because they are the leader. And this is often true for new leaders, or often when I'm with clients that have just gone up to another level, maybe gone from first line to second line manager or their first director role. And it's an identity that we take on sometimes just by being given a title, that we attach a lot of beliefs to that we should know all the answers. And so really challenging the internal dialogue is a great place to start and notice and observe what you hold to be true about your role in the relationship. So if your personal prose has lots of shoulds in it, such as I am the more senior person, or I'm the manager, therefore I should know the answer, or I should be able to help them, then it's time to really get honest and challenge that. Because when you think about it, you could argue it's almost a level of arrogance to think that we are the provider of all solutions just because we have a title. So this is the time to channel your inner coach. You're there to provide the questions, and their job is to search for the answers. So together, it can be a partnership and not an exchange where you walk away with another three things to do on your to-do list. I was chatting with a client the other day, and she's really passionate about developing her team and nurturing talent. And she's got quite a big team, and it's tripled the size of her team. And she took great pride in spending a lot of time in one-to-ones, coaching them and supporting their development. And now that her team has grown exponentially, she's struggling to see how she can give the same quality of attention and investment to the development of her people. And we got into a conversation, and she was really, really resistant to changing it, but obviously couldn't see how she could fit all this in. And I think what it threw up was this pattern that I see on a regular basis from leaders, that they've created this definition of what it means to support others, and it's become outdated and no longer serves them in their new context. And they're often also very attached to an identity about who they are as a leader. And it's not that they need to shake that off completely, but there is some readjustment that needs to happen as things around us change so that we can still create results. And we've talked about, you know, managing internal dialogue and the beliefs that we have about things, and all of these things, along with our values, prop up our identity. So when we challenge our identity, we just need to examine our values and our beliefs and the internal dialogue, because that's what's propping up our identity. And it's not about totally deconstructing it, but it is about examining what is still current and relevant and tweaking it in response to what is, you know, our next phase. So when you value developing and helping others, it can be really difficult to pull away from your definition of what support is and what help is, because it can feel like you're abandoning the other person, or you worry that you won't be perceived as someone that doesn't care. And I literally see clients wince when I challenge them on this, because they just can't bear the thought of one of their team members or their colleagues thinking that they don't care. And this is where we really have to examine the definition by which we're measuring ourselves against, and whether that is valid and an appropriate definition. Because if we're continuously stepping in and intervening, which we have as a definition of supporting and helping others, then not only are we adding unnecessary and inappropriate items for our own to-do list, but we're also robbing them of the opportunity to learn and grow for themselves. So as leaders, should we not be looking to foster independence in our teams and helping them learn and grow for themselves, rather than stepping in, intervening, ideally to the point where we can step away for a period of time and they can function and perform without us? Because if we've created a dependence, albeit unconsciously, on needing our help, then we're not actually helping and supporting them at all. We're merely encouraging lazy thinking and dependence. So think again about your definition of help and support for your team. Should it not be about helping them learn and grow, rather than taking things off their to-do list? So I'm a great gesticulator. I love to wave my hands around when I get excited and passionate and engage with things. And it's something that I've learned to metaphorically sit on my hands in an effort to step out of any rescuing behavior. Because on a very practical note, I'd really encourage you, particularly if you are someone who is expressive, to start to notice what happens inside of you when that pull or compulsion to help and say yes arises. And one of my favorite mentors talks about right sizing. I don't actually know if that's the phrase she uses, but that's how I remember it. And the question really is, am I the right size in this system right now? Too often, when we slip into rescuer or helper mode, we've become too big from an energetic perspective. It's really seductive when someone comes to you with a problem or a challenge or even an ambition or a dream that ignites something in you. Maybe you've experienced it before yourself, or it's something you're particularly passionate about. Maybe it's just something you're really good at. But I invite you to notice what happens inside of you, because for me, I notice that I sit more upright, maybe even lean forward. My voice gets a bit louder. It gets a bit more animated. I definitely gesticulate a bit more. And these are all physical cues for me that I might be about to move into rescue mode, because that really seductive invitation is there because I know the answer, or I've been there, I've done that, or I've got some information on it. And as I said, you know, it's really seductive, and it's then that you can lose awareness and you're straight into solutioneering and helping and interfering. And before you know it, you're convincing yourself that it's sparring or brainstorming. So just observe yourself over the next few days and metaphorically sit on your hands. Practically, you might literally sit on your hands. So think about what you can do to change your physiology. When you start to notice that you start to rise or get bigger energetically, how do you intentionally course correct that? Maybe that means leaning back in your chair. Maybe it's taking a few deep breaths. Maybe it's opening your posture. But just play with it and notice how that changes the dynamic. And then finally, think before you commit. So many people say to me, oh, I'm just not very good at saying no. Overcommitting is really easily done, particularly for ambitious, overachieving, action-orientated women. And as I've probably said many times before, it's really easy to overestimate what you can do, what you have capacity for, true capacity for, and underestimate how long and how much energy certain things take. And there's nothing wrong with saying yes and helping, but do it with awareness and do it with boundaries. So if you're saying yes, here are some questions that you can ask yourself and be honest about. If I say yes, is this helping me or is it helping them? Am I saying yes because I'm worried they'll like me less, disrespect me less if I say no? Am I saying yes because I'm worried about negative repercussions? Or am I saying yes because it gives me a sense of control? So think before you commit. Doing the right thing isn't necessarily the easiest thing. And sure, it's hard to watch others struggle and even make a mistake, but we all know some of the best lessons are from the hardest experiences. You don't have to completely abandon your people. In fact, you don't have to abandon them at all. Absolutely be there to catch them when they fall, to help them process what is happening for them. We're just redefining what it means to help and support others. So no, you don't have to abandon them, but you most certainly don't need to abandon yourself either. Thanks for listening to Your Permission to Pause podcast. Please rate or review and follow or subscribe in Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you are a leader who wants to work smarter, not harder, so that you achieve the result you want without abandoning yourself or well-being in the process, go to joecowlin.com and find out more.